Like others, I want to begin by acknowledging that we assemble on the unceded land of the Wurundjeri people and to pay my respects to their elders past and present. I did imagine the book as a public intervention as well as a contribution to Labor movement debate. So I do just want to briefly do a couple of things. The first of those is to explain why I wrote the book. And the second is to draw out just three insights that I think may be relevant to contemporary struggles. So first off, why write the book? Well, it really comes from two impulses. The first of those was admiration, and the second of those is alarm. The admiration is the admiration for the achievements of the Australian Labor Movement that pioneered the eight-hour day and the winning of a full weekend. That reduced the working week from a standard of 60 hours in the middle of the 19th century to around 40 hours in the middle of the 20th century. That I think is one of the great social movements that defined our society. So, powered by that admiration, I wanted to recapture and recover those campaigns, but not just to narrate them, but to explain why and how they were successful. So that's one impulse that drove the book. The second impulse was alarm, because like others, I've experienced a growing loss of control over working time over the course of my working life. And that has family dimensions. I think about my father, who was a truck driver, who, when I was young, often worked long hours, but always he worked his standard hours and then he worked overtime. And I can recall, you know, us getting a colour TV because he did extra overtime. That was him when he was in his 30s. By the time he was in his 60s, at the end of his working life, he was working as a casual, he was working 55 hours a week. He had lost control over how much he worked because if the work was there, he had to take it. I think about my mother, who was working full-time and juggling elder care because we lived with my grandmother, and the struggle she had to combine both roles, the exhaustion and the emotion. And then I think about my own life, where I've had this wonderful working life, but once wonderful children arrived, the struggle to be a good parent, to be a good worker, and to be a good partner became extremely difficult. So that's just my family experience, and I know looking across that people would have very, very similar experiences, and the social research that's done confirms that. I cite in the book the wonderful research from the Australia Institute, which sadly shows the prevalence of unpaid overtime in our society. Last year, it was 4.1 hours of unpaid overtime every week for a full-time worker. The OECD, of course, ranks the work-life balance across its member states. Across those 38 member states, Australia is seventh last for a work-life balance. So really, the impulse to write the book comes out of that dual consciousness, the admiration for the achievements of winning the weekend and the eight-hour day, combined with alarm of how we've lost the capacity to reduce our working time, apparently. And so what I wanted to do in the book was to trace the struggle over working time from the 19th century through to the present, to explain the successes, and also to explain the contemporary challenges in the hope that that could help to contribute in a small way to ongoing struggles. The first finding that I hope is of value to the labour movement is the reminder that nothing is easy, that reducing hours at work, winning back time, has never been easy. This was no uninterrupted forward march. We celebrate justifiably the 21st of April 1856 as stonemasons and other building workers won the eight-hour day, but it's often forgotten that that wasn't then easily extended across the workforce. It took many decades for it to cross barriers of skill, of gender, and of race. And equally, it was a very slow progress from a 48-hour week, which is what was won by the stonemasons in 1856, and then the 44-hour week, which won people a half-day holiday on Saturday afternoons. My favourite example of this slow process and difficult process is New South Wales, which in some ways was the pace setter of the movement for a 44-hour week. In the aftermath of World War I, there were a series of strikes that prompted a royal commission into the possibility of a 44-hour week. A Labor government was in power, and I think, like in the tradition of good royal commissions, they knew what they wanted to find out from this royal commission, which recommended a 44-hour week. And in the aftermath of that royal commission in 1921, they legislated for a 44-hour week for New South Wales workers. But that was then overturned when the Conservatives were elected, and it was rescinded in 1922. Labor argued for it again, won re-election, and reimposed it as a law in 1925. They lost power again, and the Conservatives won power and again removed the 44-hour week legislation in 1930, before Labor finally won power again and reimposed it more permanently from 1931. Now, that's just one example of one state. If you actually looked at the story of how the 44-hour week was won, it's much more complicated across the Commonwealth. And this pattern continued with later decades and later struggles, including for the 40-hour week and the 38-hour week. I think, therefore, an historical perspective on our history of trying to win back time offers a valuable insight. We can't expect easy victories or uninterrupted progress, but neither should we be discouraged when the going gets tough and there are reverses, because that is consistent with our history of the struggle for justice. The second argument that I wanted to make in the book, the second insight, is that there were changing arguments for reduced hours over time, reflecting changed notions of what was fair. So workers never simply said, we want to work less. Rather, they shared and developed sophisticated arguments to justify why we should work less. And I think these arguments actually merit recovery and continued attention, because they have often slipped out of the public sphere. As I say in the book, there were three distinct arguments for a fair day's work that were developed across 175 years. The first of those, an argument for human rights. This said that the worker is a human being, and that as a human being, a worker is endowed with certain capacities. Because we're human, we have the capacity for autonomy and free choice. Because we're human, we have the capacity for learning and for discovery. Because we're human, we have the capacity for self-rule, for participation in self-government. And because we're human, we value social relationships and we want time for family and for friendship. But what workers said in the 19th century was that long hours were preventing the exercise of these capacities, so that they couldn't explore the full range of what it meant to be a human alive. And so the fight for reduced hours was a fight for the humanity of the worker. And that sense of the meaning of that fight galvanised the movement and drew attention across the 19th century. In the 20th century, a new argument began to hold greater sway, and that was an argument based on technology and productivity. Basically, this argument said, well, technology disrupts workers' lives. It creates unemployment, it makes old skills redundant, it often reduces a worker's scope for autonomy and for creativity at work. It also often makes work more unsafe and unhealthy. Workers said, well, if technology disrupts the lives of workers and it generates profits for employers, then workers merit some compensatory reward. And across the 20th century, they said that the benefits of new technology should be shared with employees in the form of reduced time at work. And they argued that this should be especially so because when we work in combination with machines, we get tired, we're fatigued. And when we're fatigued, we work with less productivity, so that if we reduce our hours, we'll actually work with greater efficiency and greater purpose, and the economic costs will not be great. And this argument that technology and productivity justified reduced working hours held sway all the way through into the 1980s. I think it disappeared somewhat from the public's consciousness in the 1980s, but I'm very pleased that, among others, Michelle has brought that argument back in the context of the recent Productivity Roundtable. The third argument for a fair day's work is based around household labour and gender equality. And really, it's a critique of the narrowness of the movement for an 8-hour day, because the 8-hour day was always built on a fallacy. The idea of 8 hours work, 8 hours recreation and 8 hours rest implied that once you clocked off work, there was no more work to be done at home, no food to prepare, no one to care for, no cleaning or washing to be done. Women led the campaign and led the arguments that household labour and caring work needed to be recognised in our understanding of what work was, and hence in our understanding of what a fair day's work should be. The book tries to recover that advocacy and those arguments that were very present in the 19th century, but were silenced or ignored, but then became more insistent and eventually were heard in the latter part of the 20th century. My conclusion is that these arguments now lay at the centre of our understanding of a fair day's work. However, they haven't been adequately registered or expressed in meaningful institutional change. And that, of course, is one challenge for us as a contemporary movement. The final insight I hope that might be valuable to the contemporary labour movement concerns the means of change, because that's also a preoccupation of the book. What I try and show in the book is that working time has never been reduced through merely persuasive advocacy. No matter how rational, no matter how persuasive you are, that's never going to be enough to oppose the interests of business. Hours have only been reduced when a diverse and committed social movement has made this matter a social and political priority so that it could not be ignored. And the social movement for reduced hours has reached out across culture, industry, and politics. And I try and show in the book the richness of this social movement, the richness of its contribution to culture, the ways in which lectures, essays, poetry, art, including some of the banners in this Trades Hall, monuments, and of course histories were central to the cultural expression of this social movement, as were popular festivals like the 8-Hour Day. And what I try and underline in the book is that the memory of past struggles has never been an add-on for the capacity to win back time. It's always been absolutely central. And I hope that this book is in that tradition. Alongside a cultural side, the social movement to win back time has had an industrial side. It inspired the formation of unions. It was a cause of union recruitment and mobilisation, I think as it is today and as I hope it will be in the future. And I try also in the book to show the great creativity that workers showed in the different kinds of action they undertook. Strikes, boycotts, go slows, and sometimes the unilateral regulation of working hours. The insistence that we're only going to work a certain number of hours no matter what. And alongside culture and industrial action, of course, was political action. Public meetings and demonstrations were important to the 8 hours campaign of the middle of the 19th century. So was lobbying, electioneering, and speech making, and they remain important across the 20th century as well. I try and show in the book how legislation also played a role, as well as the deliberate use of the public sector as a pace setter for conditions for the economy as a whole. And my overall finding is that the movement was most successful when campaigners pursued both cultural, industrial, and political struggles together so that each of them reinforced the other. And what I try and reconstruct in the book is how the combination of these different kinds of struggles, as well as legal interventions, led to the most sustained and powerful gains for workers. The winning of the 8-hour day, the 44-hour week, the 40-hour week, and the 38-hour week. Across the book, I try and treat a fair day's work as an ongoing quest, as a dynamic current in Australian history. And my small hope is that this book is a small contribution to the advancement of this important pursuit.